Going to speak about, we have a concept that appears a number of times in halacha known as lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. The Torah was given to human beings, the Torah was not given to angels. We're all expected to make mistakes along the way, we're all expected to do things in a normal, natural way that a human being would act. So one example of that is the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin Daf Nun Dalet says, obviously one is not allowed to get private benefit from the Big Day Kahuna. Big Day Kahuna are considered the property of Hegdish, and a Kohen is not allowed to use them for his own purposes. And yet, the Gemara says, even though he's not allowed to use them for his own purposes, and even though Big Day Kahuna are certainly Aser Bahana, and they don't belong to him, they belong to Hegdish, yet the Gemara says, the minute that the Kohen finishes the Avodah, he's not expected to take his clothing off that second when he's done. We give him some time, says the Gemara, why? Lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. And Rashi explains, what does it mean? You can't expect Sheyiyu HaKohanim's Rizim kemalachei hasharis lehavshitam b'gmar Avodah. You can't expect them that the moment that they're finished with the job that they were asked to do, that they just are going to take all their clothing off and move on to the next activity. V'lo yashum aleihem achar ha'avodah ke'arafayin. You can't expect that. That's unreasonable. And therefore, says the Gemara, lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis is the guiding principle that tells us, even if the Kohen wears it for a little bit longer after he's done with the avodah before changing into his regular clothing, we assume that that is permissible and there's nothing wrong at all. The Achronim talk about the mitzvah of Ksivas Sefer Torah. So as we know, a Sefer Torah takes a very long time for a sofer to write. And the Achronim say, Shayaduahu Shahayaroi Lahachmir B'Sefer Torah Yoser Mi B'Tfilin Uve Mezuzah. We really should have said, Al Pi Halacha, that when you write a Sefer Torah, the din should be more chamor than when you write a tefillin or a mezuzah. So Sefer Torah Kedushas HaChamur, number one, a Sefer Torah's Kedusha is obviously much more elevated because Shehi Torah Chasuma, that is the Torah in its entirety. Whereas a tefillin and mezuzah is just a section, a portion of the Torah that's written, and therefore a Sefer Torah certainly has more Kedusha than a tefillin or mezuzah. And second of all, he says, Le'inyan Shvua. The Prima Gadim writes, when it comes to making a Shvua in a Beis Din, they're not going to let you pick up your tefillin and make a Shvua, they're going to tell you to pick up a Sefer Torah and make a Shvua, because we all know that a Sefer Torah is much more meaningful, is much more niskadesh than a tefillin and mezuzah. And yet, even though that is the case, Lefi delo efsher sheyichtav sefer Torah kulo shalem kachol chumras ksivas tefillin. It's impossible to expect that a sofer who's spending 6 or 7 months writing a sefer Torah that he's going to be able to keep up with all the chumras throughout the time that he's writing it. That's an impossibility. And therefore, says the Achronim, we assume lefikach hikilubu kama kulos. Therefore, we allow for certain kulos along the way, which we would not allow in a tefillin or mezuzah, because we assume lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. That's what he writes. It's impossible to expect of a sofer that he's going to be able to pay attention that diligently for the entire duration of time that he's writing the Sefer Torah, whereas by tefillin and mezuzah, it's an expectation that would be reasonable. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach discusses something which is fascinating as well. He says when you have trumas and maisers that's being separated from nuts, so he says sometimes you have, let's say, pistachio nuts, I guess, and you have to take trumas and maisers off it. So you take a whole big cluster and you set it aside as the trumas and maisers, and he says it's impossible that some of those that you separated are not going to be empty. Obviously, some of them are just going to be shells and they're not going to have any nuts in them. So he says, how are you allowed to do that? If it's a truma that's mekukol or a maisa that's mekukol, it's not the right amount. So he says as well, lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. He says, the Torah does not expect us to go and look through every single nut before we give it over to make sure that it's worthy of being given. We do our best, and as human beings, that's what we're expected to do. You go and you take a certain cluster out, you give it to the Kohen, you give it to the Levi, and you assume that that is going to be good enough. The Torah only expects us to live life as human beings and not like malachei hasharis. Based on this idea, we find another halacha, that the Torah not only understands lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis, but the Torah also assumes that we are all considered to be average human beings. What I mean by that is as follows. The Gemara tells us that a dayan has a right to paskin a shayla on hilchos nida. So people come to my house all the time, and they drop off something that they want me to look at. So do I have to be worried that maybe I don't have the most perfect eyes in the world? Maybe there's somebody else who has far better vision than I do. I think I see things clearly. I think I can see your features on your face. I think I can see what complexion you have. But maybe my eyesight is totally off. And maybe somebody who has a much keener vision, maybe they would be able to see things that I'm not able to. And yet the Gemara says in Maseches Nida, Ein la dayan ala masha ein avros. The dayan is allowed to look at it and decide whether or not he thinks this is red or this is brown or it's yellow or it's something else, and he doesn't have to be concerned that maybe his eyesight is fooling him and maybe he really doesn't know how to look at things and he has to go find the world's greatest expert to look at a given color. I remember a number of years ago, I've been bothered by it ever since. I remember there was an interesting story. There was a couple that moved out to a community out of town, and there was no individual in that community that was able to paskin their shilos and hilchos nida. So whenever they had a shila on a bedika, they used to send it in the mail in a FedEx overnight to New York, and we would have people look at it by us, and then we would get back to them. So I remember one time they sent it, and they told us that they had sent it in the mail, and it didn't get there. So we said, well, maybe it got stuck overnight. Let's wait another night. Well, how long can you wait? And then it got into the major shila of Eid Sheneva. This is a big, big shila in Shulchan Aruch in Yerudea. What do you do about a woman who has a bedika, who thinks that there's something wrong with it, is not really sure what to do, sends it away to someone else to look at, and now it gets lost? What's the obligation, and what is the status of such a woman? Should she assume that she's tahora? Should she assume that perhaps it's problematic? And I remember at the time, one of the Rabbanim said, let's go onto a website, a graphics website, where they have all different shades of colors, thousands, I assume, of different shades. And he said, let's print it out for them, or let's go online with them, and let's ask them to show us what they think it looked like. I don't think that's a realistic possibility, that a person would send something in the mail, and 3 days later they would remember what kind of shade it is when you have 500 shades of red that you're looking at and 500 shades of brown. I don't know. I was too young to get involved in the conversation at the time, but I thought it was an unreasonable expectation. And yet, even though we don't know all those, what I did learn from it was that there are 500 shades of red. When I looked on that website, I did notice that there are so many different shades of colors that we might not be so keen on, and we might not see right away off the bat when we look at something. And yet the Gemara says, "Ein l'dayin ela masha ein avroza." It doesn't mean that nobody has a right to paskin a shaila hilchos nida. It means that you have to do your best, and the Torah expects us to be average. And the Torah doesn't assume that everybody has the ability to have the most unbelievable eyesight where they can see everything in the complexity of the color. We assume everybody takes it in as is. We have, let's say, the halacha by a taruvas of iser v'heter. When you have iser, gets mixed into heter. So as a major shaila, what do you do? And we know that the halacha is that if it's batel b'shishim, if there's 60 times as much in the mixture, we assume that you're able to say that the whole mixture is kasher. What if you don't know if it was 60 or more? So what option do you have? Well, why do we pick the arbitrary number of shishim? Where does that come from? So we assume that any taste that a food would have if it fell into an item, any taste that was there is going to be gone once it's 60 times overloaded with the other substance that was there originally. So the Shulchan Aruch and the Gemara talk about ti'imas kfeila ramai. What does it mean? That every once in a while when you have these problems, you're allowed to have a non-Jewish chef taste the mixture and see. Do you think that it has still a residual taste of whatever it is that fell in, or do you assume that this is the regular soup that it always was and there's nothing that's left over from whatever it is that fell in? That's what the Gemara describes about the ti'imas kfeila arama, to have the non-Jewish chef be the one to look into the mixture and to taste it and to let us know what he feels. I know in the OU, they used to have a man by the name of Jimmy, who used to be the one who was designated to have the distinction of always tasting all these different items that were sent to the OU to decide whether or not something was kosher or treif, whether or not it had too many ingredients or too few. It was very interesting to watch him do his job, but that's what they often used to rely on. And the Rishonim have a discussion. Why does the Gemara say that you need to have a kfeila, that you need to have a chef taste it? Why can you have any non-Jewish person taste it and let us know whether or not they feel that there's a taste of chicken or milk in here, or if perhaps it's been batel, it's not here anymore? And the Gemara goes through a whole discussion, but the Rishonim basically come to the conclusion that it's lav dafka, and we assume you're allowed to have even a regular non-Jew, because we don't have to go to an expert to find out how to practice the halacha. It's good enough to take an adam beinoni. The Torah assumes that we're all going to use our regular senses that we've been given, and we don't have to go to school for 100 years trying to figure out how to become the greatest connoisseur in the world to figure out whether something has a residual taste or not. And Hilchos Shechita, the Pischei Tshuva, has an interesting halacha that he discusses from the name of the Shalah Kodesh, and he says there was a Maisa B'chassad Echad. There was a great, pious individual who decided he's not eating any more meat. Why is he not eating meat? He said because he was there one time when the Shochet was checking his Sakin, was checking over his knife, his shechita knife, before he did the act of shechita. And he was checking it, and the shochet assumed that it was fine. And then he went 3 minutes later after the shechita was over, and he checked it himself, and he said, oh, you see, there was a nick in the knife, and you didn't even realize it, you didn't notice, and now the whole shechita's treif and everything's pasul, and you're not allowed to eat it. So he was all upset, and he said, from here on in, I'm not eating meat because I can't trust anybody to do the shechita. So the Shulchan Aruch HaRav and other Achronim discuss this case, and they say, well, it's not the case. If you have a trustworthy shochet who knows what he's looking for, who's done this many times before, and now he checks the knife, and it seems to be okay, and he doesn't find any psil, and he tries it a second time and a third time, and there's nothing wrong, and now somebody else comes along and says, no, but you're not looking with the microscope, you're not looking with the magnifying glass. If you would look, if you would have the sensitive skin that I have, you would realize that there was a nick in the knife. Says the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, that's unreasonable. The Torah doesn't expect of a shochet every time before he shechts an animal to go and get the world's greatest expert with the world's most sensitive skin to see whether or not there's going to be something wrong with the knife. We go based on an Adam Benoni. And finally, the example that the Shulchan Aruch gives in Hilchos Mikvos and Hilchos Nida is that we know that a mikvah, in order for it to be kosher, has to be something that is still water. The water is not allowed to be flowing. It's what we refer to as zochlin. If the water is flowing in any way, that would pasul a mikvah. Marav is in the main shul, right next door. So zochlin would pasul a mikvah. So what happens? We look at a mikvah, it seems to be still, nothing's moving at all, but we do notice that every few days the water is getting lower and lower. So obviously there's a crack somewhere. So we empty out the mikvah and we start looking around, and we can't find the crack in the tar, we can't find the crack in the wall, there's nothing wrong. But obviously there's something that we're not seeing. So there the Shulchan Aruch writes, if you did to the best of your ability, you plaster it up, you look around, you try to search for the hole in the mikveh and you can't find it, it's what we refer to as a zechila she'ena nikeris. You can't even tell. You can hardly tell. It goes down so little, so minimally every single day, and therefore we would assume, even though obviously scientifically we know that something's happening, but since the Torah expects us to use our senses, and if we use the best of our ability, we tried to look around and we didn't find it, so then we assume that it is, we assume that it's going to be a mikvah kshera. Now, all this goes without saying that in order to make a determination in Hilchos Nida, and in Hilchos Mikvos, and in the laws of Shechita, or in the laws of anything else that we described, you obviously have to have some sort of baseline information that can make you have an educated decision. Meaning, you go into a mikvah, you start looking around, but you don't know what you're looking for. Obviously, that's not good enough. And Adam Benoni is not enough. You need to have a person who's at least educated enough about the topic that you're describing to know whether or not he's making the right choice. Now, he doesn't have to be the world's greatest expert, but he has to be at least educated to the point. Why do I mention all of this? Because there are areas of halacha where we would assume that it's not good enough to have just an education. You need to have a little bit more than that. And that I refer to when the Gemara describes our reliance on doctors. So I mention this because there was an amazing shaila that came in this week. It was from another Rav. I don't know if he wants to identify himself or not. I didn't have a chance to call him today to find out, so I'm not going to give his name. But he had a shaila from his community. And the shaila was that somebody in the community was found to be a bone marrow match through the Gift of Life Registry. Now, the general assumption is that when you donate a bone marrow, the timing of the procedure is critical because the recipient doesn't have all the time in the world. And basically they wipe out the immune system of the recipient, and then when they do that, they are now susceptible, they're ready to accept all of the new bone marrow that's being given to them. Now, you don't know who the recipient is, but the likelihood, the doctors say, the likelihood is that the person who is going to be the recipient, if I'm, let's say, a religious Orthodox Jew from Eastern Europe, the likelihood is that I'm probably going to match up with somebody who has some sort of similar background to me and is probably a Jew as well. That's the likelihood. You don't know with certainty, but that is the probability, the very high probability of that's what's going to be. Now, they want to do the stem cell removal, which is a 6 to 8 hour procedure, on the day before Yom Kippur. That's when the doctors want to do this, because based on the patient, that's when they think it's a good time to do it. This person who is asking the shaila is not a great fasta to begin with, and has presented two options. Number one, should I donate on the day before Yom Kippur? Number two, should I do the extraction a week earlier and freeze the stem cells? They would do this, but they prefer not to do so because some of the stem cells will die, and it is not as likely to be successful if you freeze them for a week. The doctors say that there is no inherent danger in fasting the day after the procedure, but that they don't advise it because complications can always arise, and being dehydrated really can exacerbate any complication. The shaila is, Option number one, which option should she choose as far as when to do this procedure? Is one obligated to take the earlier option in order to avoid potentially having to eat on Yom Kippur? Is one obligated to take the later opinion option in order to increase the chances of the success of the procedure? I think it's a very chamer d'kashayla. Number two, if one donates on Erev Yom Kippur, would we recommend doing shiurim off the bat, or would we try to tell her to fast and see what happens and watch it as it goes? This is a very important shayla. It's a very important shayla, and obviously when you have shaylas like this, you need to be in contact with the doctors, and it made me think very carefully about whenever we paskin shaylas that are relevant to people fasting on Yom Kippur, we have to be very, very sure that we know exactly what the metzias is that we're referring to. So there are a number of places in Chazal where we find that the Chachamim relied on the medical information that they were given by the doctors. Case number one is the Mishnah in Meseches Yuma in the 8th Parak, where the Mishnah says, Chole, when you have somebody who is not well, Machilin oso al pi habikiyim. You have a doctor who tells you, with my medical information that I have, I think that this patient needs to eat on Yom Kippur. Sometimes that means he needs to eat like he normally eats every day. Sometimes it means it's good enough if he eats shiurim every 9 minutes or whatever it might be. But the doctor says this is what has to be done, says the Mishnah in Yuma, we must listen to the doctor. So much so that the Mechaber writes in Hilchos Yom Kippur, Siman Tav Resh Yud Ches, that if the Chole himself or herself feels, I'm healthy enough, I'm fine, I don't need the help, I don't need to eat, I'll survive, I'll make it through Yom Kippur and it won't damage my health. And the doctors tell us the person does not know what they're talking about. From my medical expertise, from my experience that I have dealing with people who had similar kinds of symptoms, I will tell you medically that I think this is a very bad idea. Shulchan Aruch says we force the patient to eat and we don't listen to their wishes. We force them to eat because we assume that the doctor is correct. Now the Bir Halacha writes in the name of the Tiferes Yisrael. He says you have to be very careful and I'll read what he says. Shavki l'ner manusam, he says, unfortunately many doctors have lost their trust of the Jewish community. Tilachol choli kali, says, for everybody that has a sneeze, anybody that has a headache, omrim tamid she kishe yis'ane yistakein. They're going to tell everybody that it's going to be a sakana if you're going to fast, and therefore do whatever you can to make sure you don't fast. Says the Bir Halacha, we have to be careful about that. You can't just listen to any doctor. You have to have a doctor who's sensitive enough to know what Yom Kippur is and the severity of an Isser Kares, but at the same time, who has enough medical expertise to give us an educated decision that is a responsible one. That, says the Bir Halacha, is something that we need to be careful about. But either way, the Shulchan Aruch tells us that this is the way we have to pasken a shayla when it comes to a chole on Yom HaKippurim. And the same applies in Siman Shin Chav Ches by Hilchos Shabbos. If a doctor tells us this is the procedure that needs to be done on Shabbos, even though it's going to engage us in Chilul Shabbos, it does not make a difference. We need to listen to the doctor. That's what we need to do. A very important source with regard to all of these halachas is the Gemara in Meseches Nida. Maybe we'll get back to that at the end because that's what we're going to focus on with regard to the trust that we have al pi halacha in the medical knowledge of a doctor. In Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin Daf Lama Gimel, Tudus Harofe Amar She'ein Hapara V'Chazira Yotzeis Ma'Alexandria Shal Mitzrayim She'ein Chotchim Ha'im Shela. In this community in Mitzrayim in Egypt, whenever they have cows that are sold, we know that they always take out the rechem. They always take out is it called the uterus in the cow also? The womb? B'shvil shalot teled, because they want to make sure that the cow will not be able to have more calves, and therefore they always take it out. And based on that medical information of Tudus Ish HaRofe, Tudus was the veterinarian, I guess, I assume, otherwise why does he know about the insides of a cow? So it says over there that based on what he said, we can make certain halachic assumptions with regard to Hilchos Trefos. We can assume that the cow is going to die within the next 12 months, is not going to die within the next 12 months, but basically they listen to this doctor based on the medical information that he had and his understanding of the situation that was in front of us. We have another halacha with regard to Meseches Nazir Daf Nun Beis. It says, Maisa, there was a story, Sheheviu Kupa Malea Atzamos Lebeis HaKnesses Shel Tarsiyim. They brought a big box full of bones. Unfortunately, it was full of dead bodies, full of bones. And Tudus HaRofe, once again, Tudus, this famous doctor, walks in, V'chol HaRofe Mimo, and he comes in with his whole team of doctors, and they start looking at all these cadavers, and they're trying to figure out what's going on. And they said, Ein kam shedra mimei sechad. We see lots of bones here, but not, there is no combination of bones that are all from one body. He says, based on my understanding of anatomy, based on my understanding of the human body, it seems to me that we have just a whole bunch of little pieces of bones from many different bodies, but there's no one body that's intact here. And based on that, Rashi says, Tudus was a baki, a mumche. Tudus understood anatomy very well. He was a doctor, and therefore he told us whether or not we're dealing with one dead body, two dead bodies, and that made a major nafkamina lahalacha with regard to Ilchas Tumah v'Tahara as well. The final source where we have it is in Maseches Nida. And this is a very important Gemara. As you'll see in a minute, it's not so clear how we're supposed to draw a conclusion from this Gemara. Amar Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok. Shnei Maisim Hele Abba Mitivin Liyavna. There were two stories that were raised, two halachos that were discussed in Yavne. Number one, Maisa Beisha Shahaisem Apeles Kimin Klipos Adumos. There was a woman who, instead of seeing a regular flow of dam, like a nida would normally see, for some reason this woman had Klipos Adumos. She had like pellets that were coming out. They couldn't understand what was going on, such a strange condition. Ubavu Shalu Asaba, and they went to ask him, Va'aba Shalu Chachamim. My father didn't know what to do. He never heard of such a thing. So my father went to the other rabbis and he asked him what to do. V'chachamim shalal l'rofim. The rabbanim said, we have no idea what this is. We've never seen this. So they passed it off to the doctors. V'yamru lahem, and the doctor said, what do you mean you don't know what this is? You don't know anything about medicine? Let me tell you what it is. Ishazu maka yeshla besoch me'eha. The woman has some sort of infection. She has some sort of problem inside of her body. Shemimena mapelas kimin klipos. And because of that, she is extracting all these kinds of unusual formulations of blood, and that's what the doctors told them. Then, the Gemara says, Tatil lemayim, you should take this blood, as uncomfortable as it is, you should take it and put it into water. Imni mochu, if they are going to wither away, if they're going to, what do you call that?
Dissolve
in the water, thank you, then we assume that it's blood, because that's what happens with blood. It diffuses, and it spreads out all over the water, and then it's going to get lost. If not, then we know that it must be from a maka that she has inside of her body, and that's what the doctors thought it was, so that's what they did. And the Gemara says a similar story happened again, where they relied on the doctor. So this is the source of a major, major discussion in the Rishonim and Achronim. How exactly do we understand why it is that a doctor should be believed in the halachic process? Why should a doctor be listened to when we have a shaila in halacha? Now, some Rishonim say the reason why is because uman lo mara umnase. We have a right to believe that there is no way that a doctor is going to put his practice on the line and tell us something that can be proven later on to be incorrect, and we're never going to trust him again for anything else. So therefore, because he's a professional, because we know that he's doing his job very carefully, and we know that he has so much on the line, he has his medical license on the line, therefore we assume that the doctor should be trusted with the information that he shares with us, and we should assume that he's telling us the truth, and that can be relied upon al pi halacha. Now, that is a very complicated area of halacha. Uman lomara umanase means, whenever a person has a fear that maybe they're going to get caught and they can lose their license, so then we have a right to believe them. It's something that the Gemara discusses in a number of places. For example, the Gemara Menachos Daf Mem Gimel talks about who you're allowed to buy tzitzis from. As we know, when you buy tzitzis, it's supposed to be tzitzis that are made lishma. You have to make it l'shem tzitzis. So how do I know that I bought it from someone who actually made them with the right intentions in mind? Maybe I bought it from someone who had a bunch of non-Jews who made tzitzis who didn't keep in mind at all that they were doing it l'shem mitzvah. So the Gemara discusses this, and the Gemara says, if the person is a professional, if a person owns a store, then we say, uman lamara umanase. There's no way that he would risk the fact that maybe I'm going to catch him in making the tzitzis that are not kosher, because then I'll have a store closed down. So therefore, says the Gemara, the Mechaber Paskins like this, if you have somebody who has a store, and the business depends on this really being truthful, so then I have a right to say that I can rely on that. And the Shulchan Aruch gives a few other examples of this as well, where we can assume that you're allowed to buy certain items from certain stores when you know that if the person is lying about whatever it is that they're telling you, they will lose their medical license, they will lose their right to practice, they will lose their store, or whatever it might be. So the Magen Avraham asks a very interesting question. In Aruch Chaim, the Magen Avraham says, well, if that's true, how come I can't walk into any meat store, non-kosher meat store, and ask them, is this kosher meat, is it not kosher meat, is it shechted, is it not shechted, and just believe them? Why do I ever have to have a hashgacha? How do you understand that? Uman lamaram nase, shouldn't you assume that he knows if he gets caught, he's going to get into big trouble? Now, you're from L.A., and we know that there was big trouble there, but what happened? I assume his store closed down. No? So, I would imagine. So why don't you always say, uman lamaram nase, and you should assume no store ever needs hashgacha, because I have a right to say, look, the guy's afraid that he's going to lose his license, and he's afraid that we're going to close down a store, or the health department is going to catch him in the lie, and therefore we have to be concerned about that, and that's enough to make somebody reliable. That's a major discussion in the Magen Avraham, in the Noda Behuda, the Dagel Merveba. They all try to figure out, where do we draw the line between somebody who is believed because they have so much at risk if they're not telling us the truth, and where do we say, no, that's not good enough, that's not going to serve as a deterrent. So this is the major shaila when it comes to doctors. How do we understand why a doctor would be believed al pi halacha? Why should a doctor be listened to when he gives us his medical information, his medical expertise, with regard to the shaila that we are faced with? And this is something that the Rishonim and Acharonim have great difficulty with. There are some who say that a rofe has an absolute right to be believed on everything they say. We assume them to be the experts, and therefore some Rishonim say the Maharik and the Mabit, they say that we have a right to say that any rofe who tells us something should be believed, and we should not question what they say. The Chasam Sofer finds that very difficult, and the Chasam Sofer writes in the 1800s, he says he thinks this is a mistake, and he thinks that we should not fully believe a rofe when he gives us his opinion. A rofe is good enough to make a suffix in our minds. So, if a doctor tells us, I think the patient is too sick to fast on Yom Kippur, that is enough of a leidas ha-safek in our minds, that's enough for us to raise questions about this person, and we know that by pikuach nefesh, we don't take chances. So if the doctor says he thinks he's taking a chance, then we have to listen to the doctor and make sure that that person eats on Yom Kippur. However, what if a doctor tells us something that, I believe that this animal is not treif because I understand the anatomy of the animals, I'm a vet, and I really have studied the animal, I know it. Or a doctor tells us this is not dam nida, and therefore the woman is tahora, and the woman is allowed to stay with her husband, and she doesn't have to be concerned. Says the Chasam Sofer, we have no right to rely on that opinion of a doctor to tell us that this is not the case, or that is not the case, or this is a treif, or that's not a treif, or this is tahora, this is tamea. We don't have a right to listen to that. And therefore, says the Chasam Sofer, he thinks that we have to limit the amount of belief and trust that we will put into a doctor. It's an interesting comment that the Chasam Sofer gives, but that's what he says. And there are others who say many different nuances of how to understand the namanus of a doctor. So the Maharik gives the following story. He says there was a woman who needed to go to the mikveh. And as we know, we're very careful about chatzitzas when women go to the mikveh, and they're supposed to go into a bath beforehand, they're supposed to be able to get all the knots out of their hair. So the Maharik says he was sent a very difficult shaila. He said there was a woman who the doctor said it's unhealthy for her to put any water near her head. If she has water on her head, if she has water near her hair, that's going to be potentially dangerous for her. I don't understand exactly what the problem was, but they were concerned that water would be problematic for her, and she needed to go to the mikveh. So what do we do? So the suggestion that the doctors gave was, well, the property of water is one thing, and that's what we're afraid of. The property of wine is something that we're not concerned about. So we suggest that she go into a bathtub full of wine, and she soak her hair in the wine, and that's something that will not cause any health issues at all. There will be no hazard in her doing so. That was the shaila that the Maharik was sent, and this is quoted la halacha in the Beis Yosef. So the Maharik says, I didn't know what to do. Do I tell a woman that she's not allowed to go to the mikveh because in the end of the day she didn't soak her hair and make sure to get all the knots out? Or maybe I should assume that wine is able to get it out the same way water is. Maybe as long as it's wet, maybe that's enough to get the knots out. I don't know. So the Maharik admits that he has no idea. So he went back to ask the doctors, can you tell me, what are the properties of wine? Will wine be able to take out the knots from a woman's hair, or perhaps wine won't do the same job as water will? So the doctors told him that not only is the woman not allowed to have water on her hair, and she's supposed to have wine, but the wine will be able to do the same job as the water does. I don't know what kind of wine this is, I don't know exactly the story, but that's what he writes. And he says the following. What? Oh, how'd she go in the mikveh at all? I don't know. I'm not sure. Good question. Gam nachon, I didn't think of that. I don't know. Gam nachon hu shetishar leosan harofim shehizhiru al rechitzas rosha b'mayim ha'im teva hayayin cham lisabech, is the nature, is the property of wine the same as the water, that it's able to get rid of the knots in the hair, or perhaps not? And he asked them this question. And he says, b'chal makom, he says, we always rely on the doctors, so why should I not believe them on this occasion? Why would I say that I have to do further research? If this is what the experts are telling me, then that's what I should be doing, that's what I should follow. And he says, I have no problems following this, because after all, we just learned the Gemara Maseches Nida says, they had a shaila, some woman had a very unusual excretion from the body, and we didn't really know what it was, and the Chachamim went to each other, and then they finally went to the doctors, and the doctors told them exactly what it was. And they listened to the doctors when they said that. So therefore he says, I have no problem listening to them here as well, because you see from the Gemara itself that we listen to a doctor even by a chashash iser kares. And similarly he says, the Gemara says in Yuma, when it comes to Yom Kippur, we'll listen to a doctor as well, even though there's an iser kares on the line. It's very dangerous if we're going to listen to the doctor and he made a mistake, so maybe he's making us violate an iser kares, yet we listen to the doctors anyway, and that's what the maskana of the Maharik is as well. The Maharit, one of the contemporaries, writes, "V'chi yifla be'enei chachmaso eich samachnu al eidus gadol harofim." Why is it so surprising to you that I'm listening to a doctor? Mi yodia lanu, he says, may I ask you, when the Beis Hamikdash is going to be rebuilt, and once again we're going to have Negat Zaras, right? How many of us know anything about Negat Zaras? Any Kohanim in the room? Any Kohanim? You know anything about Zaras? Nothing. So what's going to happen? You're going to be a Kohen, Bizban Shebeis Hamikdash Hayakayam, and you're going to go, and you're going to look around, and you're not even going to know what you're looking at. I have a friend, I shouldn't say a friend, he's 35 years older than I am, or 30 years older than I am, Dr. Freilich from Queens. I don't know if anybody knows him. He is a dermatologist. Dr. Freilich spent a lot of his energy and time trying to figure out the complexities of Hilchos Tzaras. How do I know this? Because every time there's a Talmud Chacham of the caliber to know Mishnayos Negaim inside and out, which is almost no one in the world, so Dr. Freilich makes it his business to go ask him all of his difficult questions in Hilchos Tumas Tzaras so that he'll be the expert when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. Somebody's going to have to know. Somebody's going to have to know all the different shades of white, and how is it possible that the white grew before the Nega, before everything else, and there's hair coming out of it, there isn't. All the complicated details of Maseches Negaim, says the Maharit, may I ask you, who are you going to turn to when you have that Shaila, when we have Tzaraz coming back into business again? What are we going to do then? You think the Kohen is going to know how to answer the Shaila? You think the Rabbi is going to know how to answer? Of course! He's going to call the dermatologist to come with him and check out the Negat Tzaraz and say, what is this? Is this just a wart? Is it a growth? Is it something we have to be concerned about? Is it Tzaraz? I don't know what it is. How should the Rabbi, how should the doctor, how should the Kohen know? If not, by the person who is the expert in the field. And therefore, says the Maharit, why would you say that we shouldn't trust the doctor if this is the way the system is going to have to work when we have a Beis HaMikdash itself? That's what he writes. The problem is, the Rush points out, and this is quoted in the Beis Yosef as well, the Rush points out that this is not so simple. We just learned the Gemara Maseches Nida, where the Gemara says that when there was an issue, that this woman had some sort of emission, and we didn't know exactly what it was, they went to the doctor, and the doctor said, they believe that she has a Maka B'soch Me'eha. They believe that she has some sort of problem internally, and that's what's causing this very unusual excretion to come out. Now, even though that is the case, the Rush says, look at the next words in the Gemara. The Gemara says, they tested it out and they saw. If it disintegrated into the water, if it diffused, then they knew that it was blood. And if not, then they assumed that it was, as the doctors had said, says the Rush. I don't understand. If you believe the doctors, why are you doing the test? If you don't believe the doctors, why do you ask them?
You can be the liar.
Oh, so then why do you ask them in the first place? So the Rush says he's not sure what to do with this, and the Rush says he sent his Shaila to the Rashba. He doesn't tell us what the Rashba answered him. I don't know if the Rashba never answered at all. But the Rush says that he sent his Shaila to the Rashba, trying to understand what's the pshat in the Gemara. The Gemara says they went and they asked the doctor, and then the next line it says they did a test. Why'd they do an experiment? What are you experimenting? The doctor said this is what it is. Why don't we trust them? Does that mean to say that we don't trust the doctor? That's what the big machlokus is. Says the Rush, no, that's not what it means. The Rush writes in his commentary on the Gemara, he says the answer is, that next line of the Gemara was, Chuvas harofim hi. That's what the doctor said. The doctor said, look, we'll be honest with you. We assume that this is an internal problem. And this is why she's having this very unusual flow coming out of her body. However, the doctor said, we're not 100% sure, and we'd like to test it. And the doctor said, it's a very simple way to test. Let's put it into water and let's see. If it diffuses into the water, then it means, obviously, we were wrong. And if it doesn't, if it remains the way it is, then we know that we were correct. Says the Rush, that's not an indication that we don't trust the doctor, al pi halacha. That just means, in that case, the doctors themselves saw such an unusual story, they said themselves, why don't we test it out? Why don't we see whether or not what we're assuming is really the case? This is what the Rush writes, and this is what the Beis Yosef says as well. Kiven sheyadua lerofim, Shein derech adam lihivale becheder ela biklayos. Therefore, they said, we have to do whatever we can to test it out, and that's why the doctor said we want to see in an experiment whether or not what we said is true. This is a major point of discussion in the Achronim, how exactly to understand this Gemara. Some Achronim said, like you said, maybe the Gemara is just saying, you're right, generally you have to trust the doctors. But if you have the opportunity to be Mevar, why would you be Samech on what they're saying? If you have an opportunity to do an experiment, to test it out, so why not test it? Take a second, it's almost like a second opinion. Get a second opinion and make sure what the doctor's telling you is really correct, if you have the chance to. But if you don't have the ability to do so, obviously you have a right to rely on what the doctor said. So what are you going to say? Comes Yom Kippur, and the doctor tells you, I feel this person needs to fast on Yom Kippur, needs to eat on Yom Kippur, because otherwise it's a sakanas nefashis. What are you going to say? Oh, let's test it out. What do you mean, let's test it out? That's not a place where it's efshe levrui. You can't say, well, let's see how far they can go. Maybe there'll be serious consequences to their health, and therefore that's not a place where we would say that this is an option. But where it is an option, like by Hilchos Nida, where the doctor said, if we're correct, this is going to happen. If we're not correct, that's going to happen. So why not? Why don't we try to do our best, do the due diligence, and make sure that we're not making a mistake at all? This is a big discussion amongst the Achronim, how you come out from understanding that Gemara. We have another interesting place where this comes up. I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, there was a very, very unfortunate story where we had a Isha Sharasa Dam Machmas Tashmish, which means that a woman who's with her husband, and every time that they are together, every time that they're intimate, she has blood. Now that's a major problem. And the Shulchan Aruch says if that happens, quoting Gemara, if that happens 3 times in a row, we assume that they need to get divorced. It means there's a major problem. So this was a very, very big shaila. So the shaila that's discussed in the Torah is, what happens if a woman has this issue, some sort of condition, some sort of problem, and a woman has this problem, and now a doctor comes along and says, I can fix the problem. There's nothing, no reason to get divorced. I've dealt with this many times before. I know exactly what the issue is. She has some sort of infection, and as long as I give her this kind of medication and that kind of treatment and this intervention, nothing to worry about. I got it under control. So the tour says, it's very nice that the doctor is going to tell us that, but once the woman has already seen the dam 3 times, and now we assume that she's Asura Albaila, is the doctor believed at this point to come and say, I'm going to intervene and I'm going to try something and then let's try again after I do my intervention? Well, maybe he's doing something that he's not allowed to do. Maybe he's violating the Isser of Nida, which is a Chiv Karis. Or maybe you'll say, we should trust the doctor to the point that if he tells us that he has some sort of intervention and he's done this many times before, that you don't have to be concerned. This is quoted in the Torah, and the Beis Yosef discusses it as well. Should you assume that the only time that a doctor would be believed to say that he can do some sort of medical intervention and save the patient from having to get divorced, maybe that's only after the first time she saw her, after the second time she saw her, where she's not yet absolutely asura to her husband. But what if you got to a point where she's already asura to her husband because she already saw 3 times? Is it good enough now for a doctor to say, well, I have the cure, I have the intervention? Would the doctor's opinion be trusted that far, even to allow us to listen to him in that case? I'll just close with one final comment that I saw in the Sefer Taras Abayis. That's Rabbi Avadia Yosef's Sefer on Hilchos Nida. It's an amazing set of Svarim, 3 Svarim that he has. And he has a whole discussion about this as well, by that case of Ra Dam Machmas Tashmish. And he says that the Achronim discuss it, what the Beis Yosef says, should we believe the doctor, should we not believe the doctor, once she's seen 3 times and not? So he says, all of that is moot today. All of that is not a problem today at all. Why? Achin Bismanenu. Im haspachas harafua. Now that we have had so many tremendous advances in our knowledge of medicine, im machshirim mituchkamim v'chadashim, we have so many complex machines that we can use to really get a picture, a glimpse of what's going on inside the body. Tzilumim meduyakim, you can have CAT scans, and you can have MRIs and all different kinds of things to tell you exactly what might be going on internally. Today, he says, you don't have to really be concerned like you used to be. You don't have to say, oh, well, she's Ra Dam Machmas Tashmish, and maybe it's this, and maybe it's that. We know what it is. You go to a doctor, he'll tell you exactly what's going on. He'll tell you why there's a reaction like this, and he'll explain to you. And you don't have to say, oh, I'm relying only on the medical information of the doctor, and like some sofer said, oh, the medical information keeps changing from year to year. That might be true. Might be true that it keeps changing, but he says today, when you have almost concrete data, when you can look almost inside of the body and understand exactly what's going on, some of the times, not always, But some of the times he says, certainly by this case, Ra Adam Machmas Tashmish, where the doctor can look inside with whatever instruments are necessary for him to do so, he would say that he thinks in a situation like that today, we don't really have to be so concerned like many of the Achronim were and many of the Rishonim were. Today it really wouldn't be such a concern, because it's not really that the doctor is just leaving it up to his own guessing. And he says, even if it's a doctor who might be a person who has no Yirah Shamayim and who knows nothing about Yiddishkeit and who's a mummer and who's a nachri and who really doesn't understand what the shaila is being asked, but at least he knows the medical knowledge and the medical research, he says he doesn't see a reason why there would be any hesitation to listen to such a person in a day like today. When we know, number one, that uman lamarum nase, we know that he can lose his license if he says the wrong thing deliberately. And number two, he says, today when we know that we can have so much more of an accurate read on whatever it is that's going on inside of the body, we don't really have to rely so much on the guessing game of what the doctor might be saying. We can really have much more concrete data than we otherwise may have had. So we